ears to those who are doing the rock and roll primal scream of today, which we call rap music. That music is, in fact, being sung by young people who are under the gun.
I cry every day that this government has committed $166 billion to this effort and can't find more than $200 million this year for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria.
It's a moral imperative, I think, to rebuild or help rebuild countries that you bomb and that you destroy.
You don't do that by setting up a governing council that is unrepresentative. You don't do that by not enlisting the support of the broader international community.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, September 26, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Attackers ambushed a U.S. military vehicle with a rocket-propelled grenade in the northern city of Kirkuk, killing a soldier and wounding two others, officials said today. More U.N. employees left Iraq a day after Secretary General Kofi Annan slashed the already diminished foreign staff. In the holy city of Najaf, mourners buried Akila al-Hashimi, the first member of Iraq's U.S.-appointed governing council to be killed in violence that still rattles the country after more than 5 months of American occupation. Almost 200 soldiers from Iraq arrived home today for 2 weeks of R&R in the first wave of the military's largest home leave program since the Vietnam War. Arriving at 6 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the soldiers entered the Baltimore-Washington International Airport's international terminal with backpacks on their shoulders, sand-colored camouflage uniforms on their backs, and big smiles on their faces. A dozen waiting relatives burst into applause. Privacy and civil rights groups have hailed Congress's decision to effectively kill a controversial Pentagon program to construct a powerful computerized surveillance system that critics feared would lead to unprecedented spying into the private lives of U.S. citizens. The program, whose name was changed from Total Information Awareness to Terrorist Information Awareness after an initial outcry late last year, was the brainchild of retired Admiral John Poindexter, former President Ronald Reagan's National Security Advisor, who was convicted of 5 felony counts of lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair in the mid-1980s. Hearings were held in both houses of Congress this week to review the president's supplemental budget request for an additional $87 billion to cover the cost of reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. But speaking yesterday with Peace Watch, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, a Democrat of Ohio and a member of the House Foreign Relations and Appropriations Committee, revealed that most of the money will go towards military expenses, and only $27 billion of the requested $87 billion are actually designated for Iraq itself. Meanwhile, U.S. troops in Iraq are charged up to $1 per minute to call home to their families in the U.S., and one soldier wounded in action in Iraq was charged $500 for the food he consumed while recovering in the hospital. Kaptur wondered where the $79 billion Congress awarded earlier this year had been spent, if not on U.S. troops. In addition, she expressed concern that the National Guard and Reserve troops were being discriminated against by the military, even some who are serving in Iraq alongside active regular U.S. troops. Kaptur also noted that the high number of reservists being activated leaves a shortage at home to respond to natural disasters like Hurricane Isabel. We continue our conversation with Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur today as she expresses her concerns about the U.S.-appointed governing council in Iraq, especially its president, Ahmed Chalabi.
Well, my concerns are with the governing council and his role. 11 of the 25 people that our government selected to be on that council were exiles. They didn't even live in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chalabi had not lived there for over 3 decades. Mr. Chalabi, according to many press reports and releases from the government of Jordan, was a convicted embezzler who literally escaped from Jordan rather than meeting his court sentence and lived in London for a number of years. How can we have someone like that at the head of this council? Now, I know they have 9 different people that are chosen to rotate as president, but my question is, who are these people on the governing council? I submitted into the Congressional Record the list of 25 names, and I looked at the population composition of Iraq. We say we are aiming at a representative government. When 44% of the people haven't even lived there in a very long time, what does that say? And then you look at the different religious and ethnic minorities within the country. From the way I look at the numbers, the Shia majority is seriously underrepresented on the governing council, and so is the Sunni minority. Now, I know we don't select people in our country based on religion. However, that affinity is something you have to at least be conscious of as you are setting up a group that is to help move that country toward free elections sometimes.
Well, it seems as though Mr. Chalabi has fallen into a bit of disfavor, perhaps, with the U.S. administration, in as much as he requested that the U.S. return the power to the Iraqi people, which is something that the Bush administration is not at all inclined to do.
It's very interesting, and Mr. Chalabi and Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Pearl and Mr. Wolfowitz, they've known one another for years. And so I'm not privy to private discussions that they might have had. All I know is that when a major nation state convicts someone and expels them from their country, someone ought to pay attention to that, and there ought to be more scrutiny as to who our government is picking to serve on this governing council. I have not read one good article on who these people are and how they are viewed inside Iraq by the Iraqi people. And I do ask myself the question, well, with some of the disruption we see now, are there some groups that are not well represented? Are these people not viewed as representative of the various interests within Iraq? And isn't it shocking to you that nearly half of the people haven't been living in Iraq? Mr. Chalabi was associated with the former monarchy back in the 1950s. And you say to yourself, well, that monarchy was deposed. What were their connections? Why? What were the internal politics that threw those people out of office? Our own country threw off a monarchy. The history of the development of this republic was to throw off monarchies. So what is it we're supporting over there?
So can't you, as a U.S. congressperson, introduce some sort of legislation or something that would help to better scrutinize or have an influence on this process, that governing council there in Iraq?
Well, that was one of the points I attempted to bring out at the hearing, but there was so little time to get into detail, and I had so many points I wanted to raise. I wanted Mr. Bremer to confirm and analyze the nature of the governing council. I didn't have the time to really get into any detail. That was one of my objections to the way in which this hearing was conducted.
And so Paul Bremer was before your subcommittee?
Yes.
And who was the other official?
General Abizaid, who's in charge of our troops there. He is in charge of the military operation of Iraq.
Okay. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, any final thoughts on your part?
I just believe that it's very important for the United States to win friends in the Middle East and Central Asia. You don't do that by setting up a governing council that is unrepresentative. You don't do that by not enlisting the support of the broader international community. The challenge we face is simply too large. The edge of the war on terrorism goes beyond the boundaries of Iraq. And we have to make friends in the Arab and Muslim world. We need them as partners. They can't be absent from the table now as we try to stabilize the situation. And I would hope that the administration would use its good efforts to try to privately enlist the cooperation of other countries and of other diplomatic leaders in trying to quickly move American troops out of Iraq and replace them with other international forces and put together a stabilization program that many nations will contribute to. We don't need to go it alone there.
U.S. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur is a Democrat from Ohio and a member of the House Foreign Relations and Appropriations Committee. To hear the first part of our interview with her yesterday, you can visit our website at pacifica.org.
Every day that I awake, I must be mindful that every day is all we have for us to change. see everything as it really is. Everything we have to give. And death will only tell the truth. We are alone. We are all alone. Each one his own. We are all alone. Together.
The legendary Richie Havens spends a little quality time with Peace Watch tonight in the second half of our show. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you're enjoying it, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus, joined by academics, religious leaders, and radio personalities, held a forum today here in Washington to discuss the implications and aftermath of the Iraq War, as well as to assess the occupation of that country as it nears the end of its fourth month. U.S. Congressman Charles Rangel of New York, the convener of the panel, began the discussion by comparing the present political climate to an era several decades ago, shortly after he returned from serving in the Korean War. At the time, he said the civil rights movement was just beginning to gain momentum, and he had regular debates with his grandfather over the state of race relations.
And the biggest fights that I had with my grandfather from Accomack, Virginia, is that I was so carried away with myself and the civil rights movement, I could not understand how my grandfather from Accomack, Virginia, who saw lynchings, who saw the murders, who saw my mother embarrassed, who saw my grandmother embarrassed, who stayed down there, who took this, who tolerated this, how he could say he had white friends in Accomack, Virginia. We drank and we argued and he cussed me out. I just didn't understand. It takes a lot of courage to stand up in an atmosphere that is totally against you. And the whites in this country who knew about the lynchings, who knew about the mistreatment, would tell you to pray for a better America. We got to get out of this. And thank God for Dr. Martin Luther King, who found a way to say it wasn't a black man's problem, it was an American problem, and we all got there together. I'm hoping and I'm praying, Reverend, that through this thing that we're going through, that maybe all Americans would understand that we don't run away from a fight when our country's endangered. So patriotism, our patriotism is not on the line in being critical. Our patriotism's on the line when we see our great country in trouble and we're silent.
Democratic Congressional Representative Charles Rangel from New York. Also speaking at this morning's panel discussion was Jeffrey Sachs, professor at Columbia University and director of the Earth Institute.
I believe we should get out. I think this $87 billion is a horrendous waste of our time, money, and blood. We should turn the operation over to the United Nations, which, if we were really getting out, would find real countries with real help and real military that would take a role. They don't want to join in our occupation. They don't want to build our hegemony in the region. They believe we're in there for the oil. Why should they send their troops in those circumstances? But they would if we announced we're getting out and asking the UN to correct our mistake. I want to end with one observation. Not only could we save $40 or $50 billion this year as we get our soldiers safely home, not only would we have money to provide several billion dollars to Iraq, even within that context, because it's the $51 billion for just stationing the troops that's so incredibly expensive, but we'd actually have some money to help poor and dying people, not only in our own country, but in the rest of the world. I cry every day that this government has committed $150, $166 billion to this effort, and can't find more than $200 million this year for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. If there's one thing I would pray of you and of the Congressional Black Caucus, it would be to say absolutely no to this money until we start saving dying people.
Also in attendance was Democratic Representative Barbara Lee from California.
Many, many Americans, many of our troops are dying in Iraq. I think now it's over 300. I understand another young person died again today. Over 1,200 have been wounded. And we're spending at least $1 billion a week, $1 billion a week to finance this quagmire. I mean, what is this about? Now, Congress is about to, and I mention this because it's very important that we understand what's going on here from where we sit in terms of this $87 billion. This is another $87 billion to fund the administration's war, which brings the total to about $166 billion. And there's no end in sight. And yes, this $87 billion is only the latest installment on the president's foreign policy doctrine of preemption, and we went to war under this doctrine. The president told the American people, he told the Congress and the world, that we had to go to war because Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, including a nuclear weapons program, posed an imminent danger to us. Well, we haven't found the weapons of mass destruction yet. And now the administration, of course, is changing the mission. Now Iraq really isn't about weapons of mass destruction or regime change or both or neither, but now it's about terrorism. So the American people deserve to know how this $166 billion is going to be spent, how the previous $78 billion was spent, and now what the next $87 billion is for, and just how much we have to pay, the taxpayers have to pay, to build Iraqi schools, Iraqi hospitals, infrastructure development. Now, of course, we're not isolationists, and we don't begrudge the needs of the Iraqi people. It's a moral imperative, I think, to rebuild or help rebuild countries that you bomb and that you destroy. However, what about Halliburton and Bechtel and the no-bid long-term contracts for development efforts that don't even occur in our own country? We need our infrastructure developed. We need schools. We need education. We need jobs. So what about that? How much of that is for them? So we must leave Iraq an Iraq that is stable and secure, but we must leave, and we must develop an exit strategy, and that has got to be part of our work and part of this administration's presentation to us on the Hill, and I think you need to demand that they give us that information. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., our hero, our prophet, he warned us, and let me just give you a quote, Charlie, as you mentioned Dr. King this morning. Dr. King said, in the wasteland of war, now this was way back then in the 60s, he said, in the wasteland of war, the expenditure of resources knows no restraints. Knows no restraints. So Dr. King knew that war could be and would be a bottomless pit into which this great nation could pour all of its resources.
Barbara Lee and Senator Edward Kennedy from Massachusetts addressed the Congressional Black Caucus Brain Trust.
And now where are we? We have no plan in Iraq. It's being made up every single day. And the Congress has asked for $86 billion. And when all we have to do is not say or take what Senator Kennedy said, which we could find that to the challenge either to my patriotism, and it's the old slogan, you know, go after the messenger and don't go after the message. Well, I'll just tell our friends in the administration that they better start going after the American people, because we are seeing on the front pages of all the newspapers the failure of their policy. Yesterday, Washington boasts Bush fails to gain pledges on troops or funds in Iraq. Failure to be able to get any kind of an additional help and assistance in terms of the rebuilding, or failing to get any kind of help and assistance. All we're going to do is pay the full freight for any of the troops when we only paid 8 cents on the dollar in the last war. We're paying, 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 paying. We're not getting any help from there. Now you go over to the front page yesterday of the New York Times. Draft report said, no success in the Iraqi arms hunt. The American leading the hunt for banned weapons in Iraq says his team has not found any of the unconventional weapons cited by the Bush administration as the principal reason for going to war. Yes, this is just yesterday. Then you go down, really, continue on the front page. War plans ignored worn infrastructure. This isn't the professor. This isn't Senator Kennedy. This is what is being concluded by those that are out in the field. And the next thing we understand is the activations. If you're in the Guard, Reserve, your family is, they know that they're going to be hauled up and sent over for the long period of time because, as General Abajay said, even this morning, no longer counting on foreign troops to relieve American soldiers. That's our commander-in-chief. This is within 2 days. And then what do we find out? As Charlie Rangel just handed up this morning's paper, GOP concerned over Iraq price tag. Well, I think all of us think they should be concerned. They should be concerned. And they ought to be concerned, just not in the items that we just received. They ought to be concerned the new curriculum training for an Iraqi army for $164 million. The curriculum is $164 million. 500 experts at $200,000 each. How do you like this? And the list goes on and on. And their plan, the administration's plan that was submitted to the Armed Services Committee just within the last 2 days, here it is. It's a working document of July 23rd. July 23rd. It's a draft document. We asked for the plan for Iraq. They give us a draft document, not even a complete document, dated July 23rd, and it is some 30 pages. Including the cover page. This is an insult. This is an insult to our troops. It's an insult to the American people. And let me just give you some of the wisdom on this wonderful under security items. August 1st to the October 3rd, locate and secure and eliminate weapons of mass destruction. Then it goes over what they ought to do. From November 3rd to January 4th, continue to locate and secure and eliminate weapons of mass destruction. And then if there's any question about this plan, from February 4th onwards, continue to locate and secure and eliminate the weapons of mass destruction. That is what we think of that program. And we're not going to take it anymore. Thank you very much.
Senator Edward Kennedy, civil rights leader and Democratic presidential candidate Al Sharpton critiqued the administration's war.
We must not allow them to continue to ramrod the American public with these falsities. The fact of the matter is that this war was not about imminent danger. When Mr. Powell, as the professor said, went to the UN saying they knew where the weapons were, showing videos, audios, and photos, then why are we not asking them, where are the photos and audios and videos, and compare them to where we now see there was nothing there? Rumsfeld said he knew where they were. Well, where are they? And you cannot risk American lives and then come back and tell us that we're unpatriotic when you put our children in harm's way. Then to add insult to injury, he brings his partner, the Prime Minister of England, Tony Blair, over. And you know, Tony Blair and Bush have a meeting and they call it a world conference. Two men in a phone booth and it's a world summit. So Blair comes to the U.S. He goes in front of the United States Congress because he can't speak in Parliament without them throwing shoes and stuff at him. So since he can't address his parliament, he comes to address our Congress. And he goes to the epitome of arrogance. He says, it doesn't matter if we lied. Doesn't matter if it was weapons of mass destruction. We needed to get rid of Hussein anyway. What do you mean it doesn't matter? So now it doesn't matter what we told you. If I were to tell you we better get out of this building because there's going to be a falling down of the ceiling, and then we get outside and I say, it doesn't matter, you needed some fresh air anyway. This is the game, Congressman Conyers, that they've played on the American public. Do you support the troops, Sharpton? Yes. That's why I don't want them being used and misused. Do I support the troops? Yes. That's why I want them to have health care at home like they're fighting for health care abroad. I want the troops to be given the dignity of a life that this present administration will not give them. I also want, as we run this race, to bring this party back into the party that represents something clear. When my mother registered to be a Democrat, we knew what a Democrat was. Now we don't know what a Democrat is.
Presidential candidate Al Sharpton, and on hand was the dean of the Congressional Black Caucus, Congressman John Conyers from Michigan.
All I am bringing to your hearts and minds is, what do we do? Now, let me tell you about how members of Congress's minds work, because the care and feeding of congressmen and senators is a very tricky process here. Most of them won't do anything until they hear from you. So as long as you walk around and mumble to me and Rangel and Jackson Lee and Lee about, you know, I think it's about time somebody do something down there in Washington. Yeah, it's about time we do something down there in Washington. And when are you going to tell us that it's time to do something in Washington? A member can't walk out in midair. If nobody's behind him, he's not going to do it. And if enough people are behind him, they'll get in front of me and Rangel and Jackson Lee.
And finally, Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas.
But there were people who thought, how unpatriotic could you have gotten? How outrageous was your vote when you heard the president say that we're about to be under imminent attack? Have you no reason and concern for the safety of the American people? We were pressed to the wall. But I am gratified that we were able to decipher and discern, lonely that we might be. But I think we were guided by these principles. We chose peace over war and life over death. For those of us who are poised to take the opposition to the $87 billion, it is because I choose Representative Thompson and Medicaid and Medicare and veterans' rights and education over frivolity. It is imperative that you go back home and begin to ask for bifurcation and separation of the vote. We've sent letters. We've made floor speeches. And I will stand today and tell you that these members likewise have cast a vote for the funding of our military personnel. We stand united on that.
U.S. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, among participants at a panel discussion this morning raising concerns about the outcome of the war and occupation of Iraq. The event was hosted by the Congressional Black Caucus.
Hi, this is Scott Gurian, the producer of Peace Watch. If you're enjoying listening to this show, I urge you to take a moment and make a donation to ensure that this program continues. You can make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at www.pacifica.org or send us a tax-deductible check or money order to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, 20009. And note that it's a donation for Peace Watch. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.